This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We have a new partnership on the books with a podcast called Ways and Means. It features unique research by faculty at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. But you don't have to be a policy wonk to appreciate it. Ways and Means explores innovative approaches on how to improve our society and tackle big issues like civic engagement, reparations, and local news deserts. Today, we'll hear stories about parenting and childhood development. Your guide for the hour is the host of Ways and Means, journalist Emily Hanford. We begin with a look at preschool classrooms and what research says about teaching preschoolers how to handle tough emotions.
Okay, let's go. One, two, three.
We're in a preschool classroom in Durham, North Carolina. The children have stuffed their backpacks and lunchboxes into their cubbies, and now they're circled up on the floor in front of their teacher. They're sitting cross-legged, practicing counting on their fingers.
10, 11. Do we have 11 fingers?
There are higher and higher expectations being placed on preschool children nationwide. Preschools are no longer just places for playtime. Now, kids are expected to start learning to read and write and count before they start kindergarten. What's more, four-year-olds are expected to be able to behave in the classroom, but that's not always happening. Christina Christopoulos is with the Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke University.
We have seen this trend where children come into preschool and they are having such intense problems that the preschools cannot keep them. They tell the parents, we're sorry, we just can't handle this type of behavior. So a lot of kids have been kicked out of preschool. It's a very difficult, I mean, how can you kick out a 3- and a 4-year-old from a classroom?
Research shows kids don't learn how to regulate themselves automatically. You have to teach self-control skills head-on. Katie Rosenbaum is Christina's colleague.
You need to directly teach kids the skills to regulate themselves the same way you would teach them to read or to do math. You need to instruct it, practice it, coach it, give them opportunities.
But how do you do this? How do you teach a whole class of 4-year-olds how to handle difficult feelings? Well, we've known for a long time that puppets are an effective way to talk to kids.
Many of the characters in the neighborhood of make-believe are puppets that I make talk. I'll show you.
Daniel Striper Tiger's my name. Hi.
Mr. Rogers used puppets to talk directly to children about their emotions in his hit PBS show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. One of his most famous puppets is Daniel Tiger. Here's Daniel Tiger talking to one of the characters on the show, Lady Aberlin. Lady Aberlin was supposed to pick Daniel up, but she forgot.
I'm really sorry, Daniel.
Are you?
I can see by your face that you're really sad.
Yeah, it feels awful to get forgotten.
So how are we doing today?
Good.
Good. Let me see 2 thumbs up if we're doing. Oh my goodness, friends. You are so smart.
Minnie Best is a preschool teacher at Fayetteville Street Elementary in Durham. Minnie has been teaching for over 15 years. She says kids show their emotions at school in a bunch of different ways.
In my situation, I have a child that hits. You know, the way she expresses herself, she will hit another child.
Minnie's part of a study that the researchers we met earlier are running in North Carolina. The researchers have trained preschool teachers on a classroom curriculum that uses puppets to teach emotional and social skills. The plan is to test kids at the beginning and end of the school year to see if puppets can help improve children's classroom behavior. The curriculum centers on an imaginary place called Dinosaur School.
Ready to start Dinosaur School?
Shake hands with a friend and say bonjour, shake hands.
As the children sing, teacher Minnie Best takes out a puppet with 4 ponytails held together with colorful bows.
Hello, everybody! How are you? It's so good to see you!
Meet Jewel.
It's been such a long time!
Dinosaur School is where we have a dinosaur puppet named Dinah, who is the principal of Dinosaur School, and the kids love her, and they cannot wait to see her every week, and they will do whatever she tells them to do. It's a lovely teaching tool.
This is Duke Center for Child and Family Policy researcher Katie Rosenbaum again.
And then we have a child puppet that's really the size of the kids, and that puppet provides the perspective of a child in the classroom who may be struggling to learn these skills right alongside the kids and can kind of mirror what they're going through.
Today, Miss Best is going to use Jewel the puppet to teach the children how to snap, using their middle fingers and thumbs, which they call Tall Man and Thumbkin. Snapping isn't the real point of this lesson, though. The point is for the kids to try to do something hard and work through the feelings that brings up.
Okay, how many times have you ever felt frustrated because you couldn't do something? Show me your frustrated face. Oh my goodness, that's frustration.
Today, both Jewel and Miss Best are acting like they can't snap.
Oh no! Can every show me your snapping muscles? I just can't do it.
The kids all focus on rubbing their Tall Man and Thumbkin fingers together fast enough to make a sound. Most of them are succeeding, but one little boy named Aiden can't seem to do it. So Miss Best pretends she can't do it either. An assistant teacher and Jewel the puppet are providing moral support.
Jewel, Kalia. I'm getting frustrated because
no.
I just can't do
no,
this.
No, let's try again, Miss
okay.
Best. Let's try
okay.
again.
Can everybody
are we ready?
Show
okay,
me.
On three. You ready? One, two, three.
Uh-oh, I did. Oh, my fingers came together and did it, Aiden.
So I can't do it.
Okay, but let's try.
I need some help.
He needs some help.
Okay, let's go. Ready? Okay, Tall Man and Thumbkin. Ready? Fast.
He did it!
By using the puppets, the kids relate to them in a whole different way and, I think, absorb the information at a much deeper level.
Researcher Katie Rosenbaum.
And when they see this child puppet struggling with the same kinds of problems they have, and they get to help him find a solution and practice that solution, it's a level of enthusiasm that you don't see when a teacher is just leading a class. And especially for kids who may be shy or kids on the autism spectrum who may have harder time with social interaction, they love talking to the puppet.
The teacher training part of the program is organized like a pyramid. The teachers learn that the most important thing when it comes to classroom management, the base of the pyramid, is good relationships.
And so at the beginning of the school year, all we want teachers to focus on is how do you build those positive relationships with each and every student in your class?
Yes. This is our new friend, Kalia.
Hi, Kalia.
Kalia just started yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
She's a brand new friend. She just started yesterday.
Then, as you move up the pyramid, you think about proactive strategies to use in a classroom. How do I practice the rules with the kids so that they know exactly how to behave and what I expect of them? How do I praise the child that's doing what I like so that the other child who isn't doing it right then will go, oh, I would like that praise and I want some of that too.
A present. Good job.
The top of the pyramid is all about consequences and a teacher's plan to deal with misbehavior. 240 preschool teachers in North Carolina have been trained to use this classroom management program and puppet curriculum. Researchers ran a randomized trial in 120 classrooms. Children in classrooms that used the Dinosaur School curriculum showed significant improvement in identifying their emotions, like recognizing that they're sad or angry. Those children were also better able to ignore problems rather than react with aggression or crying. And finally, teachers who use the Dinosaur School curriculum said they themselves use more positive behavior management strategies in class. Katie Rosenbaum says showing preschool teachers how to explicitly teach emotional and behavioral skills could have big implications throughout a child's education.
So think about what a high school student has to deal with. They have much more risky opportunities at their fingertips that they suddenly have to manage their emotions about, and the consequences of failing that is much worse. If I'm 4 and I get in trouble for kicking over my friend's block tower, that's not nearly as bad as if I'm 16 and I get in trouble for stealing or some other way that I failed to control my behaviors.
Teacher Minnie Best says learning how to use puppets to teach self-regulation skills has changed her classroom tremendously.
I continue to use the puppets daily because it really works. We even use our puppets doing math and counting when we have a child that's getting frustrated and we're seeing that child cannot for some reason grasp that concept, we will sit the puppet down with us and we'll say, oh, can you see that Ruby is taking her fingers and counting? And it makes the children feel at ease. That's what I'm seeing.
Okay, go ahead and start us. Goodbye, Jewel. Goodbye, Jewel. Goodbye, Jewel. We're glad you came to school.
One more time.
Goodbye, Jewel. Goodbye, Jewel. Goodbye, Jewel. We're glad you came to school.
You're listening to a special collaboration between the podcast Ways and Means and The State of Things. Travel with us now to Kenya, where there's extremely limited access to mental health care. There, you'll find just one mental health professional for every 100,000 people. A Duke professor has been trying out an innovative approach to help orphans in Kenya who are grieving the loss of a parent. Their strategy? Train local people with no mental health background to conduct a particular kind of therapy. It's called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's working.
My name is Susan, and I am 15 years old. I'm from Bungoma Town in Kenya. My mother used to take me to school, and she'd fix my hair. We had a good time. After she died, I was really sad and lonely. I had only my father who was near me, and we only had few friends because of our grief. At first I was thinking, I am alone. And how come I am the only child who has no mama?
Susan's mother died when Susan was 7 years old. Her father, Elud, hadn't been involved much in caring for his daughter. When his wife died, he was dealing with his own grief, his daughter's grief, and he had to take on a new role in his family, too.
I was thinking a lot about my wife. We were together for 15 good years. At first, after my wife's death, life was very hard. When my child saw other children being taken to school by their parents, I had to take her to school because I wanted her to also feel that she has a parent. After I reached the school, I had to come back home and go looking into how we were going to survive that day. Then, maybe I'd be doing a certain job and it would be getting late. Then I'd have to stop working and go back to the school to take her back home. So it was difficult.
In Kenya, nearly 3 million children have lost one or both of their parents. Across Africa, the number of orphans is enormous, nearly 50 million children going through the grief of losing at least one parent. Why are so many parents dying? It's mostly HIV/AIDS and respiratory infections. And when it comes to what to do about this problem, the focus is often on medical interventions to stop the dying. But what gets lost is this other huge public health problem in Africa, widespread grief and the trauma that comes from losing a parent. This has major consequences. Being orphaned is often associated with other problems, problems like substance abuse, dropping out of school, or unemployment. Orphans are also more likely to engage in risky sexual behavior that may lead to new cases of HIV and perpetuate a vicious cycle.
My name is Catherine Wetton. I'm on the faculty in public policy and global health at Duke University, and I direct the Center for Health Policy and Inequalities Research.
Kate Wetton has worked in 5 different countries over the last 15 years, exploring the needs of orphans.
One of the things we realized early on was that the children were suffering not just from lack of food and housing and safety, but also in their grief and being able to work through anxiety that they had. And the caregivers who we were interviewing also were asking us, what can we do about the child's grief? What can we do about their anger?
To try to answer that question, Kate joined forces with Shannon Dorsey, a child psychologist at the University of Washington. They ran a pilot project in Tanzania and then a larger trial both in Tanzania and in the part of Kenya where Susan and her father live.
So Bungoma is a beautiful part of Kenya. It is in the Rift Valley, which means it's quite high. You kind of go up the valley to get there. It's about a 9-hour bus ride from Nairobi.
Bungoma is the second most densely populated region outside of the capital city, Nairobi. A sugarcane factory employs some people, but many of them are subsistence farmers. They raise chickens and cows. They grow millet, sorghum, and other crops. Poverty is common.
There's a high proportion of people who go to bed hungry and who are really struggling to survive and to keep their lives together. They estimate 15% of the children are orphaned, which is really an incredible number if you think about any classroom or group of 100 kids, that 15 of them have been orphaned by at least one parent.
The need for mental health care is huge in Bungoma. Problem is, there aren't enough people trained to provide it. Here's Shannon Dorsey.
So in Bungoma, like in most low and middle income countries, there aren't enough mental health professionals. So there just aren't enough psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, and those that are available tend to work with individuals with more severe needs like serious mental illness or schizophrenia.
The U.S. research team works with an organization in Bungoma called ACE Africa. This is Cyrilla Amanya, the organization's research director.
I come from Bungoma. As we speak, in the area in which we are operating, Bungoma, we only have one mental health expert and one retired nurse who took interest in trying to solve issues of mental health disorders. So you can clearly see that there's a gap and there are very few practitioners. I think that my society deserves better.
What the researchers needed to figure out was a low-cost way to provide therapy to orphans in a part of the world with very few therapists. How do you do that? One thing you need is a therapeutic approach that doesn't take months or years to be effective. So if the word therapy conjures up an image of a patient lying on a couch talking to a counselor for years, erase that image. Because there is an effective short-term approach. It's called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. It's been around for more than 25 years and has proven effective in more than a dozen countries. It helps people deal with all kinds of terrible experiences. Here's Shannon Dorsey again.
Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is an intervention that works on thoughts and feelings to help kids cope, feel better, and be less scared about potentially traumatic events in their life that have happened.
Cognitive behavioral therapy is based on the idea that our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are all interconnected and influence one another. It's called the cognitive triangle.
So a kid who's thinking, no one loves me, I'm all alone, or even I'm the only one who does not have their mama still alive, that child may be feeling more sad, more worried when they think that way. And then they may act in certain ways related to those feelings. So when they're feeling sad and worried, they may isolate themselves. They may try to leave school. They may not try to come close to the individuals that are still in their lives, like the surviving parent or another guardian. And with the cognitive triangle, part of what we're trying to teach kids is that thoughts, feelings, and behavior are connected. And that if we can change the way you think about a situation, so the example I just gave, a child might change to think, yes, my mama is gone, but I have my BB, my grandmother, I have others in my life who care for me and who will love me. Then that child might change their feelings to feel more hopeful, a little less sad, and maybe more likely to be able to focus on their schooling and connect to other individuals.
Children in the Bungoma pilot project practice relaxation techniques to lessen their anxiety. Things like counting backwards slowly or tossing a ball back and forth with someone else. A course of cognitive behavior therapy typically takes between 8 and 20 weeks. In Bungoma, the course was called Pamoja Tunaweza, or Together We Can. Both children and their guardians were involved, and the course ran for 12 weeks. Here's Kate Wetton again.
The guardians or caregivers also go to class every week, so they're learning the techniques that the children are learning.
In the United States, cognitive behavior therapy typically happens one-on-one. But for the pilot project in Africa, researchers adapted the method to be used in groups. That was one cost-cutting approach. But what about the lack of therapist problem? The way the researchers tackled that one was to teach lay people how to run a course of cognitive behavior therapy. So regular people, with little or no background in mental health, were trained to lead the Pomoja Tunaweza course. The researchers supervised these lay counselors as they implemented the cognitive behavior strategies with children and their caregivers.
So we measured outcomes really carefully. Kids answered the same questions before the intervention, right after the intervention, 6 months later, and then a year later.
With their pilot studies, the researchers discovered this approach worked. Compared to orphans who got no special attention, the children who completed the 12-week course with the lay counselors had less anxiety and depression and fewer relationship problems.
Kids showed that they were feeling less worried, less scared, having fewer nightmares, feeling less alone, less sad. And when our counselors would be in the communities for other things, the guardians and the children would run up to them and say, Mwalimu, Mwalimu, which means teacher, and really ask and seek their guidance.
Susan, the girl we heard from earlier, was involved in the Bungoma pilot study. Susan says Pomoja Tunaweza helped her in a bunch of ways. For example, she learned she wasn't alone in dealing with her grief.
I found that a lot of kids had no parents, and for some kids, both parents were dead. My life has changed. Now I know I have other people who can take care of me, apart from my mother who died.
Susan's father, Elud, says his daughter became more comfortable socially. She started inviting other kids over and even taught them the relaxation techniques she'd learned. He says the course helped him too. His own trauma from being orphaned had been ignored, but he learned the same strategies Susan learned. He also learned parenting skills. For example, physical discipline of children is customary in Kenya, but Elud said he learned different ways to handle Susan when she acted out.
It used to be, after her mother died, at the end of the day, maybe I am tired from work. I've been toiling for the whole day. Reaching home, you can find you just have to beat the child or even abuse her because of lack of knowledge on how to bring up a child in a good way. But we attended the sessions, and right now, from the teachings, we have changed the way we behave and the way we handle the situation. I don't think the way I used to.
The research team was encouraged. In poor communities with limited access to healthcare and practically nothing for mental health, lay people could make a big difference for a relatively low cost. Here's Duke researcher Kate Wetton again.
That's a really important step, that of saying, okay, you don't need the U.S. trained psychologist to do the training and supervision. So if that's true, this could be what we call scalable. Local people who are from the area and who love children and work with children can become the trainers for a large group of people.
The researchers wanted to know, after the successful pilot project, can this approach be used to help a lot more of the nearly 50 million kids in Africa trying to deal with the loss of a parent, but getting little or no mental health help? Can it be scaled up? They have a new study going on in Bungoma and nearby villages to try to answer this question. It involves 40 schools and 30 health centers. Lay people, like community health volunteers and school teachers, are being trained to implement the cognitive behavioral grief therapy. Only this time, there are hundreds of them. Lutungu RC Primary School in Bungoma is participating in the project. Lutungu RC has about 500 students. Children arrive as early as 7 a.m. and finish the day around 5. They share desks and books.
So you have a teacher standing up in front of the 100 children with a chalkboard, and the teachers tend to, because people don't, there aren't enough books, and so the teachers are writing out the textbooks and the kids have to memorize what they're seeing.
Kenya's primary schools up to grade 8 are free, but children must buy a uniform and supplies in order to attend. The head teacher at Lutungu Primary School told us there are 52 orphans at the school. He says most of the orphans are learning without payment because their guardians cannot afford a 5-shilling charge for supplies. That's about 5 cents. He sees the orphans struggling with basic needs like shelter, food, and clothing. Kate Wetton says orphans also face all kinds of stigma.
They're often considered a burden on the family. They are considered by teachers and others oftentimes to be troublemakers, to be lazy, things like that.
Many orphans end up dropping out of school. The U.S. Research Project will reach 1,280 orphans. They'll learn strategies to deal with their grief, so hopefully they will be able to stay in school. The researchers' goal is to create a detailed blueprint for scaling up the model of training laypeople in these techniques. They hope that maybe, if they can show it can work on a large scale, the Kenyan government would fund a national program.
So we now know that TFCBT works. We know that lay providers can implement it with success. What we need to see now is, what does a school need to do to be able to implement this? So do you have to have your principal on board? Or is it sufficient that you have three teachers who are really excited about this? Or what happens if the school is very poor and they really don't have capacity to do this? So we're really looking at the characteristics of the environment within the schools, and then similarly with the community health volunteers.
Early rounds of the study will guide later rounds.
My name is Lilian Nandutu Aluka. I'm a lay counselor. I train people on TFCBT, that's trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy.
Lilian Andutu Aluka has been trained in the cognitive behavior techniques, and now she's training others who will become grief counselors, both in Bungoma schools and in area community health centers. On a chilly spring morning, we visited the very first training for these new counselors. They were gathered at a small hotel called Silent Resort. There were 32 of them sitting on white plastic chairs at narrow tables. Six instructors were there to train them.
Today we have been teaching about the committing father relationship and introduction to circle of life.
It's a six-day course, and this is day five. The Circle of Life section is about helping orphans and their caregivers plan for dates that can trigger sad memories, such as birthdays or the anniversary of a funeral. There's also a lesson on helping children shift their focus away from the lost parent and helping them begin to form other relationships.
What I taught today was about trauma narrative. This is a children and caregivers learning to cope with stress about the death of their parent. These are difficult memories.
Lillian says she's eager to see the experiment succeed. There is so much need, she says, and she thinks there must be a public investment in helping orphans deal with their grief.
I hope that the government and the Minister of Health will see that this program is really working. It's really changing people's life. It's really changing the children's education, like performance in school. That's just my only hope.
If the team is successful, more lives might be transformed, like Susan's and her father's lives were. Susan's the girl we met earlier. After her mother died, Susan says she was angry and wanted to drop out. But since she learned strategies for handling her feelings, she's still in school, and she's even learned to think about her mother without being overwhelmed by grief.
Before the program, it was very difficult for me to come out of our house, but now I know I have other people. My mother is no more, but life has to continue.
That was another story from the podcast Ways and Means from the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. If you go to their website, waysandmeansshow.org, you can see pictures from the trainings and the schools. In today's final story, we'll dive deep into a program that started in Durham, and it's helping more North Carolina families thrive.
Hey, hi. That's a microphone. You want to say anything? Not today.
We've popped in on a new mother's group in North Carolina. There are a dozen or so moms and infants in the room, in a big circle. Moms are sitting cross-legged on the floor with their babies on pillows in front of them. This group is known as the New Mothers Hangout. A doula, which is a woman who gives guidance and support to moms-to-be and moms with newborns, meets each new mom at the door.
Hello, baby. That hairdo is everything.
I know, right?
Kate Vanneman Scheidler from Chapel Hill is showing off her 6-week-old son, Colson.
I'm like, I don't know why, but also it's very overwhelming. Like, I've gone out, but for some reason, it's just like, we just went to a Target run before, too, and he screamed the entire time, so.
Colson cries a lot. Kate would ask her friends and her mom, is this right? Do babies cry this much? People would tell her, that's just how it is.
There was a lot of babies cry. Babies cry. And I'm like, no, I'm telling you, this is not normal. Like, there's something inside of me that's saying this is not normal.
But every time they went to the doctor, Colson would fall asleep in the car. So the doctor never saw the intense crying jags. It took weeks for Kate to figure out that something was actually wrong, something that was eventually fixed by medicine. Those weeks felt like a lifetime, up around the clock with a new baby screaming. It was stressful and exhausting, not knowing what was wrong. And it shouldn't have to be that way. In fact, if Kate lived just one town over in Durham, North Carolina, the issue probably wouldn't have taken so long to get a handle on. That's because Durham has a free program where nurses visit brand new mothers in their homes. The nurse would have been more likely to witness Colson's intense screaming and to get mom and baby help more quickly. The visiting nurse program in Durham is called Family Connects. Home visiting programs are nothing new. They exist in other communities to support low-income families. One of the things that makes the Durham program stand out is that all families in the city, rich and poor, are eligible. The project was started by Duke professor Ken Dodge.
We go into the hospital, we welcome the family, the baby into the community. We deliver the message that every parent can be successful, but no parent has ever been successful alone. And so we invite ourselves into their home to follow up, to learn what they need.
The program is based at Duke University. It officially started in 2008 as a pilot project. At the time, child abuse rates in Durham were unusually high, above the state average. Researchers thought that a home nurse visiting program might help. Ken says sometimes abuse can be prevented with support and education. Early on, his team interviewed lots of new mothers, and two of these stories stick in his mind. One new mother had slapped her 6-week-old baby so hard it left an imprint.
She had just bizarre ideas about what babies could and could not do. She said she was changing him one night and he peed all over her. And she got so mad that she needed to teach him a lesson. And she slapped him. Well, you can't teach a 6-week-old baby a lesson.
Ken tells another story about a 23-year-old single mom who worked an overnight shift cleaning offices. She had two children, a 3-year-old and a 9-month-old.
Every night at 10:30, a babysitter would come. One night, the babysitter didn't show up. She panicked. Babies were asleep. She locked the apartment door from the outside, went to work. At 2:00 in the morning, one baby woke up, cried, woke the other baby up. They're screaming. A neighborhood came and knocked on the door. Nobody was there. Called the police. Police came, knocked the door down, found two babies alone, and arrested the mother for child neglect. It was 9 months before she saw her babies again. She was trying hard. She had a poor plan and no backup plan. That could have been prevented.
It's not that a nurse visiting program would have provided overnight childcare, but this mom clearly needed someone she could call for advice, someone to talk through her options with before she made the decision to leave her children alone.
So do you want me to walk you through how we kind of start a visit? Yeah.
Tamara Sidorov is a Family Connects nurse. Her job is to go from house to house, meeting new parents. One of our producers, Carol Jackson, met her in a parking lot outside the clinic where she works.
We are at your car.
It was a typical summer day in the South, really hot.
In my trunk, I've got all my nursing gear. So I have my nursing bag here that has a blood pressure cuff for mom, as well as alternative manual cuffs as well, a scale, a head circumference tape, a pen light, thermometer, and of course,
Tamara visits two new mothers each day and is on the phone with many more.
So I have diapers and swaddle blankets and breast pads and thermometers and nipple shields and What else do I have?
She and Books. Carol set off for a drive around Tamara's territory. They start in an urban area on the edge of downtown Durham. There are a lot of small, one-story, single-family homes. Some have porches and flowers. On others, the windows are boarded up.
I mean, this is a real, like, on-the-go job. You have to be flexible to so many different environments. Okay, well, there's a stop sign there that person did not oblige to. That's okay, sir. The dangers of a Durham Connects nurse.
The nurses work with all kinds of moms.
Yeah, we see moms and their babes from all walks of life. So we see teenage moms, we see moms in their 20s, we see moms in their 30s, we see moms in their 40s. We see moms from all countries, we see American moms, we see moms who have all of the socioeconomic resources and are still having challenges. We see moms who are underprivileged and are also having challenges. We see such a range of families. And I think also, like, going into a family's house, you see such a raw reality.
For privacy reasons, Tamara didn't take us inside a home to observe a visit. But Allison Kuvadia told us what a visit is like. A Family Connects nurse visited her and her husband when their first baby was born. They just couldn't seem to get their daughter to sleep.
She did not sleep at all. And she would make these little noises when she did sleep. And I would jump up thinking something was wrong. She'd gotten tangled in her blanket or something. And I would hover over her, pack and play. And then she would wake up because I was hovering over her. And it was this just sort of horrible cycle that just continued and nobody got any sleep for the first few weeks.
Allison and her husband were exhausted and anxious. And then the Family Connects nurse showed up.
The nurse came, knocked on the door, and brought in a scale to weigh her on and had the tape measure. She had a few gifts for the baby and for me, which I thought was very nice. Nice lotions and some bubble bath. And I believe she even brought baby books for the baby. And she measured her and weighed her and did a well check on her. And of course, everything was fine. But it was wonderful to have the extra set of eyes to take a look at her.
Allison felt reassured. She was less worried about messing things up. When her second and third children were born, even though she was more experienced, she again welcomed home visits by Family Connects nurses.
Instead of being a mom with one child, I was now a mom of two children or a mom of three children. And so questions about siblings and questions about what do you do with your oldest child who's 1.5, almost 2, when you're trying to nurse an infant, they were able to help with ideas for that.
Allison had plenty of time to talk with the nurses about anything and everything.
The thing that I think is fantastic about the program is the time the nurse comes and spends with you. The second and third visits from the nurses lasted an hour or an hour and a half. I offered one lunch, I think, because she'd stayed for so long, but they had so much information about things going on in the community that could benefit me. The La Leche League information, programs that the fire station were doing for things like smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors. They're just a wealth of information.
Family Connects is short term, usually just a visit or two. But the nurses arrive armed with ideas about where parents can get further assistance in the community, whether it's help with postpartum depression or finding childcare. You're just not going to get all that in a trip to the doctor's office.
The pediatrician visits are fantastic, and I love our pediatrician, but they are short. So I think the real thing is the time.
It's a cool new trick, isn't it?
We're back with the new mother's group.
We had a Durham Connects nurse come by the house. I forget her name, but she was wonderful.
Zawadi Walker is here with her 10-week-old baby, Cora. Zawadi says she got practical advice from the nurse, including learning a new swaddle technique for baby Cora.
This is called the square swaddle, because little Cora here was like a Houdini. She would always get her arms out of the traditional swaddle and wake herself up. But our nurse showed us a different way to swaddle, where her arms stay down and she's very comfortable and sleeps a good 4 hours.
Sawadi's on leave from a local university where she works as an executive assistant. The Family Connects nurse helps Sawadi think through how she's going to keep breastfeeding when her maternity leave is over.
She mentioned the conversation that I might want to have with my supervisor, you know, talking about the times that I want to feed, and gave examples such as getting to work early, perhaps breaking the one-hour lunch break down into 20-minute sessions.
Family Connects is offered to every single mom who gives birth in the city of Durham. And most moms want it. 9 in 10 women say yes to the program. It's funded by the Duke Endowment, the Durham County Government, United Way, and other grants and partnerships. As I mentioned earlier, nurse home visiting programs are not a new idea. They're widely used in some European countries. But researchers say the Family Connects approach of offering the program to every mother for free reduces stigma. You're not getting a nurse visit because you're poor or somehow deemed at risk. You're getting a nurse visit because everyone in the community gets one. And all new parents have questions and concerns. Not all Durham moms got the home nurse visits at first. Back in 2008, when the project launched, it was set up as a randomized control trial. Some moms got the nurse home visits, some did not.
For the first randomized control trial, we took every birth in Durham, North Carolina, resident to a Durham family over an 18-month period. That was about 4,800 births.
This is Duke Sanford School of Public Policy faculty member Ken Dodge.
And we randomly assigned them to receive the program or not, based on the date of birth. So if you were born on an even-numbered birth date, your family was randomly assigned to receive the Durham Connects intervention. If you were born on an odd-numbered date, you were in the control group.
Researchers gathered data on both groups to try to figure out what kind of impact the project had. They found that families who received the nurse home visits had better outcomes on some key measurable indicators.
The results are really straightforward, that families randomly assigned to an even-numbered birth date receiving Durham Connects were indeed more connected to community organizations at 6 months of age, were better at providing positive parenting, according to in-home observers who didn't know whether they had received the intervention or not. And they had fewer emergency room visits for illnesses and injuries, and less likely to appear on a child abuse registry, Child Protective Services records.
Researchers calculate that for every $1 spent on the nurse home visiting program, $3 was saved in avoided emergency room visits. Preliminary findings also show a significant reduction in child abuse investigations for children ages 0 to 5.
Those were very gratifying results.
It would seem like a program like this is a win-win. The families involved find it helpful, and researchers can document cost savings to governments and to hospitals. But Ken says not everyone reacts positively to the idea of a program like Family Connects. Some question why it's needed at all. People say things like,
"When I was a child, my mother stayed at home. My family made it alone. Why can't they pick themselves up by their own bootstraps and succeed? Why should a community provide support? Why should governments provide a support? Why should even health insurance provide a support?"
Ken believes these concerns are outdated because society has changed.
Families have too many challenges. The challenge of work, trying to put food on the table, do all of that, is just very difficult. And successful families have never done it on their own. Successful families have always had those community resources, whether it's the church or the neighborhood or extended family or the affordances of wealth. Successful families have always had that. It's more low-income families that have been denied those kinds of resources. And if we really want to have population impact and provide positively for the entire community, we've got to provide those resources more.
In addition to Durham, Family Connects is also in Forsyth and Guilford counties in North Carolina. They also have locations in many states, including California, New York, and Texas. The stories you heard today come from the award-winning podcast Ways and Means. It's a production of the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. You'll hear more from that podcast next week on The State of Things. And you can visit our website in the meantime to check out last Monday's episode, which was all about climate change. Ways and Means is produced by Carol Jackson, Allison Jones, and Karen Kemp. It's hosted by Emily Hanford, who worked at WUNC for many years. You can find out more about Ways and Means at their website, waysandmeansshow.org. You can also subscribe using any podcast app. And a reminder that we are still checking on you and want to know how you're holding up during the COVID-19 crisis. Tell us your story. Are you getting good at homeschooling your kids? Have you found the right self-care routine to help pass the days? What's the one event that was canceled that you were really looking forward to? Share your experience or ask a question or send a text message to 919-980-5419. That's the state of things for today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.